Shrink Wrap Radio Number 332, The Emerging Psychotherapeutic Consensus with Dr. John B. Arden.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is clinical psychologist, workshop leader, and author, Dr. John B. Arden, and we'll be discussing some of the ways that the field of psychotherapy is becoming more coherent and less fragmented. John Arden, PhD, has 35 years of experience providing psychological services and directing mental health programs. Since 1999, he has served as the Director of Training for the Kaiser Permanente Medical Center's Northern California region. He's developed one of the largest mental health training programs in the United States. In this capacity, he oversees more than 100 interns and postdoctoral psychology residents in 22 medical centers. Prior to this, he served as the Chief Psychologist at Kaiser Permanente Medical Center in Vallejo, California. Dr. Arden's study of neuropsychology has inspired him to integrate neuroscience and psychotherapy, synthesizing the biological and psychological into a new vision for psychotherapy, brain-based therapy. His work incorporates what is currently known about the brain and its capacities, including neuroplasticity and neurogenesis, with psychotherapy research, mindfulness, nutritional neuroscience, and social intelligence. He conducts seminars on brain-based therapy throughout the United States and abroad. Dr. Arden is author of 12 books, and his most recent one is Rewire Your Brain, describing how the general audience can utilize the practices of brain-based therapy. You can read more about Dr. Arden and his publications in the show notes on our site. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John B. Arden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure to have you here. I should let listeners know that a month or so ago, I was introduced to you by fellow psychotherapist and Shrink Wrap Radio listener Ashley Taggart, who said that the two of us really should get to know one another. Turns out you live in the same neck of the woods, more or less, as I do. So she arranged for the three of us to get together for lunch in Petaluma a few weeks ago. And as I recall, you and I hit it off right away and discovered a number of points of commonality and shared passions. And one of those shared passions was a sense that there's some sort of emerging consensus about psychotherapy that more or less obsoletes past theoretical debates dividing the various schools of psychotherapy, or as you have said in one place, the flavor of the month. For me, this has been a sense emerging from my more than 400 podcast interviews now. And so I got really excited when I discovered that you've written an article spelling this out in some detail. In your article, which is titled The Rise and Fall of Pax Medica, was published in the Psychotherapy Networker, and I'll be sure to include a link to that article in our show notes. And it's that article that will be the focus of our conversation today. So that's more talking than I usually do in these interviews, give you a chance to say something here.
Well, that sounds like a really good focus for us today.
Okay, I'm glad you think so. Well, as you point out in your article, your use of the term Pax or Pax Medica refers to the historical Pax Romana. Now, it may not be that all my listeners are familiar with the historical Pax Romana, so that might be a good place for us to start. Fill us in on that, if you will.
Sure. It's a play on words. And you know, when you think in terms of what was going on 2,000 years ago in the Mediterranean, there was a Pax Romana occurring, meaning a Roman peace. You could travel anywhere in the Roman world, and as long as you didn't insult Roman gods, Roman law, everything's cool. you could practice your own little religion and have your own little community and all that, but you got to know who's in charge and not insult the hierarchy. Well, similarly, we have been in Pax Medica roughly since about 1980, whereby it's been essentially the medical model. And as long as you know who's in charge, psychiatry, everything's cool. Treatment is medication. And what the psychotherapists do essentially is all this nice supportive therapy and helping people along and all that. And I'm of the opinion, and certainly a number of other people share this opinion, apparently you as well, that we're ready for a revolution. And I think the revolution is actually occurring now, whereby the old one-dimensional model of Pax Medica is dissolving. In fact, many of the pillars of Pax Medica are now crumbling with the efficacy studies related to antidepressants and all that. But, you know, as we're talking about this, I think it's important to understand why Pax Medica developed in the first place.
Yeah, tell us about the situation before that piece that was brought on by Pax Medica. For example, what sort of care would a person with emotional problems have encountered prior to, say, the 1960s?
Well, I would say disorganized care. So if you look at what was happening between, let's say, 1890 and 1980, we had what we can refer to as the Cartesian era occurring, whereby therapists practiced a variety of different techniques and adhered to a variety of different theoretical models, headed up by a guru of that model. And those models were so wide and ranging. You had anything from radical behaviorism to primal scream to analysis of Jungian archetypes to CBT to then all sorts of alphabet soup types of clubhouses. And the efficacy studies for these therapies were really actually quite bad. In fact, Hans Eisneck, the very famous psychotherapy researcher back in the early 50s, I think 1951 or 52, did a study that showed that the mere passage of time was as effective as psychotherapy. That was a bad blow for us.
Yes, it was. Now, you know, you've kind of skipped ahead. We were the question had been, what was it like before Pax Medica?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. well, what you had was a variety of different types of therapists out there that had very little commonality among one another. So a client would go to one therapist and they might talk about interjected self-objects. Another person would talk about reinforcement paradigms and they'd get really confused. And unfortunately, the therapists themselves of these various schools wouldn't collaborate. There wasn't very much cross-pollinization because these schools seemed to be headed up by a guru type that was sort of more invested in their particular stature in their school and everything. And as a consequence of all that, both the clientele and the mental health community were confused about the sort of a common thread between them. And the reason that this Cartesian era occurred was that we didn't know much about the brain at the time. You know, if you think back about 100 years ago, we didn't actually know much about the prefrontal cortex, the brain's brain. So people like Freud, who was actually a neurophysiologist, wrote about 100 articles before 1890 on such arcane issues as the anatomy of a crayfish and other subject areas, left the brain because we didn't know much about the brain. And right. So that lack of grounding left us to this sort of brainless psychiatry that, you know, is a play on words again from this Cartesian sort of concept, you know, based on this idea that Rene Descartes was sort of a dualist. Actually, you know, ironically, he was attempting to unite the two. Did a not so good of a job, but nevertheless, this era of brainlessness lent itself to this plethora of schools, this plethora of clubs. And as a result of that, you had these efficacy studies that I began to talk about with Hans Eisnick and others showing little efficacy for psychotherapy. Another person that we like to mention a lot, in fact, we mentioned in the article there, was Timothy Leary, who actually was the chief psychologist in the system I work in, the Kaiser Permanente system, way back in the early 60s. And he did a study that found that people on the wait list did as well as people in psychotherapy. And then, of course, later on, he went to Harvard and then started heading out into the psychedelic world. But
Eisnick, of course, was famous for doing that study and finding that people on the waiting list seemed to do about as well as people who got treatment. And I didn't realize that Leary had replicated that study. But what was the flaw in Eisnick's approach? Because I gather that finding has been overthrown.
Well, you know, I think that by the time of, let's say, the late 70s, the research methods had perfected. So if you look back at the early 50s, when Eisnick was doing his research, he was focusing on psychotherapy in its current form. And in its current form, you had a kind of limited range of approaches, and one of them being probably the most dominant, psychoanalysis.
Yes.
So it was not as, let's say, accelerated as the brief therapies that emerged much later, and certainly CBT being one of them. So it seems to me that what Eisnick was looking at was a snapshot in time. Perhaps had he done his research by the late 70s, he might have found better efficacy. In fact, the big meta-analysis, David, that you probably know about, that was done by Smith and Glass, 79-1980, found that psychotherapy actually was useful. So that was an analysis of multiple studies that found better efficacy. And that was very heartening for all of us, because you and I were in the psychology world back then. We felt, I was at the University of New Mexico at the time, and we thought, oh my God, thank God, what we've been doing all this time. There's some relevancy to this. There's some positive effect for our clients. Unfortunately, the convergence of all these factors that you could say blended together to create this Pax Medica overshadowed the Smith and Glass studies. And shall I go on and talk about those convergent factors?
You know, I just want to dwell a little bit more on the Pax Medica. And in your article, you talk about the impact of Prozac on the one hand and cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, on the other, as leading to this period that you refer to as Pax Medica. So take us through a bit of that, if you will, of the impact of Prozac and CBT in this.
Sure. If you think about what was going on in psychiatry in the late 70s, there were a variety of different types of psychotropic medications used that had moderate efficacy. And one of the principal classes of antidepressant medications were the tricyclic antidepressants, you know, Elavil and all of those.
Yes.
And those medications actually were rather dangerous if a person were to overdose on them. And in fact, during that time, in the mid-70s and actually all the way through the 1980s, I was involved in this deinstitutionalization movement and working in community mental health and running programs and all that. And on one particular period, in fact, at 1 year, I lost three people to a tricyclic antidepressant overdose. Three.
Oh, wow.
People. So that was really dramatic. And it underscores the problem that the antidepressants then, being you know, the tricyclic antidepressants, the TCAs, and also the MAO inhibitors, had, because those were our principal antidepressants at the time. And then through the emergence of the SSRIs, the Prozac and its cousins, now you had a class of medications that didn't kill you when you're overdosed on them. So if you're thinking in terms of depressed people and the potential lethality, this was a major advance. This was great. Even though we now look at it as a rather limited kind of perspective, but if you turn back the clock and look back then, you think, wow, that was a big advance. Now you have antidepressants that have a little bit better efficacy and they don't kill you when you overdose on them. Simultaneous to that, we had an increasing dominance of a particular theoretical school, and that being the cognitive behavioral therapy school. And that particular therapeutic approach was much more science-based, at least at the time, than a lot of the other therapy schools. In fact, there was more research on CBT than a lot of the other groups, in part because there were particular methodologies that CBT developed for specific diagnoses. For example, panic and PTSD and OCD. And the focus on diagnosis and medication, a la the SSRIs, resulted in a convergence between evidence-based practice and the use of medication.
Yeah, and you talk about diagnosis, and in your article, you spend a little time talking about the role that the DSM...
Another factor in the emergence of Pax Medica was the publication of the third book of bad names, DSM-3. Now, it was so much better than 2 and 1. And in fact, it was three times the size of DSM-2. So back in 1980, when all these converging factors occurred, you had DSM-3, the development of the SSRIs and evidence-based practices, which were largely CBT approaches. So with regard to that third factor, the DSM, now you had a variety of different diagnoses that had less theoretical base to them. For example, the word neurosis was dropped out of DSM-3. There was a little bit more science to this third book of bad names, and many people that were in the mental health community at the time, you and I, thought, well, geez, I don't know if you did, but I certainly did. Geez, there's a little bit more relevancy in this package of diagnoses than there were before. But I was always very critical of overdiagnosing people anyway. So there was some benefit and some drawback.
I wanted to have you talk a little bit, because when we talk about diagnosing, I mean, that really puts us square in the middle of the medical model. And so comment, if you will, on the upsides and the downsides from your perspective of the medical model.
So the advantage of DSM-3 and its more so-called science base in terms of these diagnostic pictures helped us all get on the same page, whereby these so-called therapists of a variety of different creeds would use the same language. And we weren't using the same language before. We were all over the place. So DSM-3 provided us with a language base that put us roughly on the same page. Now, the downside, of course, is the tendency to overdiagnose and to try to always put people in these little pigeonholes. And in fact, a good friend of mine, Lou Cozzolino, calls it the tendency to get real rigid. In fact, he calls it the hardening of the categories.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that that's a major problem overall, because I think we're too focused on putting people in these diagnostic groups. And in fact, you might even say that the new DSM that's coming out, DSM-5, with many more diagnoses, has certainly a lot of rigidity to it, so to speak. But at the same time, there's some positive aspects to it. But we can get into the more recent developments in a little bit. But the convergence of the clinical focus with diagnosis, with a specific methodology, therapeutic methodology prescribed by CBT, and medication. So you had SSRIs, cognitive behavioral therapy, and a diagnostic group sort of funneled us into one frame. And that one frame sort of screened out everything else. And there was a benefit in that we were all speaking the same language, but the drawback was that that language was very limited and one-dimensional. And that's what my good friend Lloyd Linford and I call the one-dimensional Pax Medica approach, the medical model. And there is a language to the medical model that I've always been rather concerned about, and that has been the emphasis on clinical. In fact, even the word clinical kind of bothers me a little bit. People now like to call themselves clinicians, as if therapist or even counselor that's just too nebulous. I don't really know what you're talking about there, and not sophisticated enough. And many people started losing the word counselor for psychotherapist because that sounded more sophisticated. And then they then moved to this clinical approach because now we could all refer to ourselves as clinicians. And I've sat in many so-called treatment, there's another word from Pax Medica, treatment groups whereby people share their opinions and one person might clear their throat and go, well, clinically speaking, I think that his problem is this way. Well, it's as if they're now defining the language. You know, what were they speaking before? Now they're speaking clinical, so to speak.
Yeah. Initially, there was a lot of research supporting the efficacy of Prozac and its cousins, but later that research has been called into question by subsequent studies. In fact, in your paper, there's a section titled Reconsidering SSRIs. So what was that research? Maybe you can take us through that.
Sure. You know, during the last 10 years, several major articles have appeared in journals such as the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, and others, casting doubt on the efficacy of antidepressants. And there have been a variety of different studies that I might highlight. One being a reanalysis of the major Pax Medica study that found that the best performing psychiatrist, that is the person with the better relationship with the client, did better with a placebo than the worst performing psychiatrist, that is the psychiatrist with the not so good relationship with the client, had with the medication. So in other words,
I love that.
The relationship was more powerful than the medication. So let's set that one aside and then take a look at another study that found that the use of SSRIs yielded a efficacy roughly about 10% greater than a placebo. And if you wonder about those people actually taking the SSRI who get a variety of different side effects, you know, there's quite a range of side effects, including sexual side effects and some insomnia and difficult stomach and so on and so forth. They might even get a placebo effect from the medication that might result in some efficacy. You know, oh my God, well, my stomach is quivering and all that. Something must be going good here.
Right, exactly.
And then there was another really intriguing study done by researchers at Arizona State University that wanted to highlight serotonin. And I think it's really important to
think in terms of this variety of neurotransmitters that we have in our brain as not immaculately conceived or being created by medications, despite what the drug cartels would have us believe. These neurotransmitters, serotonin, GABA, dopamine, all the variety of neurotransmitters are actually made by our body by synthesizing specific amino acids that we take in to our system through our diet. So what these researchers did at Arizona State University was restrict the amount of tryptophan in the diet of three different groups of people. And what tryptophan is the amino acid precursor to serotonin. So in other words, what they were doing was lowering the amount of serotonin in the subject's brain. And here's what they found. With people without a family history of depression, there was no bad adverse consequences in terms of mood. With people with a family history of depression, one-third, not three-thirds, of the people got depressed. Then another group, which I find particularly concerning, was the group taking SSRIs. That group got depressed in 5 hours after the restriction of tryptophan. Now, what is that all about? Well, many people in the mental health community have long been concerned about what I like to call serotonin poop out. We see a lot of people that have been on an SSRI for quite some time. You know, let's say they've been on Prozac, and all of a sudden it begins to sort of peter out. The efficacy peters out. The psychiatrist might have to up the dosage, maybe get up to the top range around 80 milligrams, and still it doesn't work. And the poor psychiatrist has to now shift to another medication. Perhaps they go to Celexa or something else, and that doesn't seem to work. And then they have to reach for Hamburger Helper. And I don't know if you've heard of Hamburger Helper, but or seen these commercials on television. If you're not, your medication's not working well, why not add another medication, Abilify, to help that medication work better? Now you've got people taking medications with an added medication to make the medication work better that they were taking initially and at limited efficacy anyway. So here what we have is a artifact of long-term use of SSRIs that's rather concerning.
Yeah.
I frankly believe that we go to medication too quickly. I wonder if I might say a few words about alternatives to going too quickly. We know now from a number of different studies that aerobic exercise, and you don't have to go to a fancy gym and put on a leotard and jump around and all that to get aerobic exercise. You can just walk very quickly. Aerobic exercise is as effective with mild and moderate depression as medication. Aerobic exercise is as effective as psychotherapy and is as effective as psychotherapy and medication combined. So, why go to a medication right away when you can get good side effects from the exercise instead of going, you know, having all these side effects and all that? You can get good side effects.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine there's not much motivation for the for Big Pharma to widely promote that.
No, but let me say that in the system that I'm working in, we're promoting walking. And we're promoting it nationally for a number of chronic problems, depression being one of them, but certainly metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and other areas. And I think that this approach, which I'd love to get into a little bit, this more integrative approach, is the wave of the future, that we're taking a look at all aspects of health rather than just this little snapshot, this one-dimensional track called Pax Medica. You have a missing brain chemical, serotonin, and let's go in there with this medication to prop it up as if you can isolate serotonin and kick up the mood.
Right. Now, are you collecting data? You say you're taking a different tack system-wide. Is there any research that's being done on the efficacy of this approach that you're undertaking?
Well, there have been a number of major studies at Ohio State University, Duke University, and others that have shown that this overall approach works. And in the Kaiser system, we're looking at overall health. And overall health includes the major problem that we're now experiencing around metabolic syndrome and certainly diabetes too, which has bidirectional effects on mental health and health, because we know that people with diabetes or metabolic syndrome have a tendency to get more depressed. And if you get more depressed, you have a tendency to develop diabetes more easily. So it works both ways. And then if you get diabetes too, then your propensity to get dementia earlier goes up. In fact, some neurologists are now calling Alzheimer's diabetes 3. So if you want to accelerate the production of plaques and tangles, get diabetes 2. Now, let's back up, of course. We're talking mental health. Way before you get to those extremes, this bidirectional or let's say multidimensional directional kind of interaction is what our focus is now in this wave of integrative healthcare, that mental health practitioners ought to be looking at all these dimensions simultaneously instead of this little Pax Medica one-dimensional model whereby we're just thinking in terms of a specific neurotransmitter that needs to be propped up as if it isolates or you can isolate it alone.
Okay, let me cut in here. I gather that CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, has gone through a similar cycle as Prozac did of initial glowing reports that have subsequently been called into doubt. Tell us a little bit about the rise and fall of CBT.
Well, you know, CBT was, let's call it a very common central approach. It would be really hard to argue that pessimism and negativistic thinking might not result in sort of a downer mood, so to speak. So enter CBT with Albert Ellis, in the 60s, and then certainly Aaron Beck in the 70s, and everybody else thereby following. It was a very common central approach to people's problems, helping people think more clearly. And it helped us get out of this plethora of schools with the debate and everything else, because it was so clear and sensible, reasonable. So the emergence of CBT, I would say in the late 70s and certainly through the 80s, contributed to a general consensus across the mental health community, even if you were a psychodynamic person, that talking to a person about their negativistic thinking was a good idea. But during the 80s and the 90s, many of the CBT approaches were very focused on specific, almost manual-like approaches. And by the 90s, many of the CBT approaches were part of what we then later called evidence-based practices. In fact, they were the ones that were more largely researched. So by the 90s, during the era of managed care, or I call managed dollar, you had all these reviewers from the insurance companies reviewing private practice patients' treatment plans, saying, if you're not practicing this particular approach, which include, by the way, a medication and a CBT approach, then you don't get payment. So all these private practitioners were kind of funneled into this CBT medication approach. And then what you had was a counterattack in the psychotherapy research area of the outcome management people and others like Michael Lambert, John Norcross, and Scott Miller saying, well, wait a minute. These manual-based approaches, they leave out the person, don't they? You know, you're just more of a technician than anything else. What about the relationship? And they were finding that one of the major, in fact, the most important variable in the overall outcome in psychotherapy was the quality of the relationship. So if you go to any of the psychotherapy research conferences, you'd see a battle between the evidence-based practice people and the outcome management people. And that led to some important critique of the CBT approach. Now, the CBT people, on the other hand, have grown and have moved away from a manual-based. In fact, people like David Barlow at Boston University and others are now looking for common factors among these various approaches. So even the CBT folks have kind of moved in the direction that we were talking about earlier, this more integrative approach. So what you had was initially the emergence of CBT as a consensus around logic and sensibility and all that, and then a manualized approach that that sort of channeled everybody in this Pax Medica. And now more recently, because of some very good and important critique and debate, now even the CBT people are converging with everybody else. So you have
Yeah, that's really exciting, and I had the chance to interview both Scott Miller, who you mentioned, and David Barlow. So I want to move us around, or rather move us along, because we want to get to really the heart of your contribution. So we come to the new synthesis that I referred to in the beginning of our discussion, and this is the rise of what you refer to as brain-based therapy. And you and your co-author very clearly outline a rationale under which a wide variety of psychotherapeutic approaches can be understood and refined in the light of recent findings in neuroscience. So tell us a bit about this vision of the psychotherapy of the future that integrates neuroscience.
Certainly. Let me say at the outset that it isn't necessary to refer to this next sea change in psychotherapy as brain-based therapy. I mean, you can call it whatever you want, as long as it's considered a integrative approach. The reason my good friend and co-author Lloyd Linford and I came up with this term brain-based therapy was to get us all on the same page and include neuroscience in this big picture. So if you think in terms of a big puzzle that we've been trying to put together for quite some time, we've spent a whole lot of time on certain pieces of the puzzle. The psychological theories areas where you have all the different types of therapies with their respective gurus, CBT, as we were just talking about, and the psychodynamic many incarnations of that, now the DBTs and the ACTs and everybody else. Well, those are the clubhouses, and certainly the theoretical approach, even though you could say there's some science to it, involves diagnosis. You could say the psychological theories include diagnoses. Well, also, the therapeutic alliance has long been part of the picture, and you mentioned Scott Miller and Michael or John Norcross and certainly Michael Lambert have focused on the therapeutic alliance as being a major part of the outcome. Well, that's part of the picture too. So we want to have the psychological theories, the therapeutic alliance, and let's not throw away evidence-based practices. I think that they have matured. And there isn't an evidence-based practice for everything, but when you're talking about panic, for example, or PTSD or OCD or depression, there is a robust literature around what might be the more efficacious approaches. So we don't want to lose that part of it. So evidence-based practice, certainly part of this picture, and it's more recent developments. And then enter neuroscience. Well, now we know so much more about what depression and anxiety look like in the brain. It's very rare that you would get a person that has an anxiety disorder without an overactive amygdala and a overactive right prefrontal cortex. and simultaneously an underactive left prefrontal cortex. So affect asymmetry, amygdala dynamics, and all of those neuroscience discoveries ought to be part of the picture. And we also know how to get active those areas that are inactive, like, for example, the left prefrontal cortex. So we ought to be taking a look at what kinds of therapeutic approaches help balance out the functioning of these cast of characters that we call our brain.
Well, as a talk therapist, how is it that you would stimulate one area of the brain and tone down another area?
Okay, so let us talk about affect asymmetry, and let me introduce it by saying that there have been some major researchers highlighting the differences between the left and right prefrontal cortex. Richie Davidson from University of Wisconsin, who I'd really encourage you to interview sometime.
I have already.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah. David, you have a gold mine, and I've been listening to many of your podcasts, and I haven't discovered that one. You've got, what'd you say, 200 or so?
Actually, with another series that I did on top of this one, it's over 400.
My God. Incredible.
You're number 332 on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Amazing. Well, I'm honored to be part. Richie Davidson, who you had the pleasure of talking to, has since the mid-80s focused on the relative activation of the two prefrontal cortex, left and right, and the so-called set point. And then Robert Robertson, who's a neurologist from Washington University in St. Louis, has also focused on the relative activation of the two prefrontal cortex. And here's the general concept here. Overactive right, underactive left, you have more depression and anxiety. And more balanced activation between the two, or let's say a ratio of activity leaning a little bit to the left, as Davidson calls a set point, you have more of a positive mood state, for example. And what behaviorally is associated with the activation of these two prefrontal cortexes? Well, with the right prefrontal cortex, what you have is withdrawal and avoidant behaviors. Now, what does a depressed person do? Well, he or she withdraws, pulls back. What does an anxious person do? A phobic or somebody with PTSD or whatever. They tend to try to avoid things that set them off, or what people colloquially call the triggers, so to speak. And what happens as a result? They get more anxious. So to withdraw, you get more depressed. And so withdrawal and avoidance overactivates the left prefrontal cortex. Now, how do we get the right prefrontal cortex, I'm sorry. How do we get the left prefrontal cortex activated? By approach behaviors, by doing what you don't feel like doing. That's actually a phrase I use over and over again. I know you don't feel like doing this right now, but we need to kind of kickstart. We need to sort of pop the clutch, as it were, to kind of get you started. And doing something kicks on your left prefrontal cortex. And interestingly, the CBT approach for depression is called behavior activation. So there's a nice confluence, you could say, between these behavioral dynamics that relate to brain dynamics. You see what I mean? So
yeah.
In other words, activating your left prefrontal cortex by doing something balances out the relative activation of the two prefrontal cortex.
So I gather, in the example that you've just given, you actually advocate speaking with the client about their problem in terms of brain functioning. So what's the value of that, of, you know, telling them about left and right frontal lobes and amygdala and so on?
I now talk about the brain with almost all my clients if they're anxious or depressed. And I also teach an anxiety class, and I call it a class because I'm teaching my anxiety plagued clients about their brain. Why do I do it? Because it gives them a general understanding of what's going on. Let's face it, right now, if you turn on PBS, you might end up seeing a special on neuroplasticity or neurogenesis or a topic on new developments in neuroscience. And you might even see a feature article on the brain in Time or Newsweek or U.S. News and World Reports or whatever, not just Scientific American. And so people out there now are reading about the brain, and it's more accessible. This material is more accessible. Psychotherapists ought to also participate in the dialogue and use this material to help motivate our clients. So my clients often say, geez, now that you put it in those terms, I can see what's going on more clearly. It gives me a sense of hope. So when I talk about neuroplasticity, for example, and how the brain rewires, they get a sense of practice actually results in the acquisition of a new habit. Let's face it, we are just full of habits. We have good habits and we have bad habits. And anxiety and depression are just bad habits. And they can be bad emotional habits. And there are methods to create new, more positive habits. And they ought to be learning about these habits. And psychotherapists ought to be the participants in this new venture of helping people learn about how to use their brain more effectively. And they can do that by psychotherapists actually focusing on the brain.
And I gather there's less stigma when it's cast in the form of the brain, that people feel some kind of burden is being lifted of a sort of a moral failure on their part.
Oh, that's a wonderful point that you're bringing up, David. In fact, I often say that, you know, how Michael White in narrative therapy focused on externalizing the problem, whereby he said, well, you know, the problem's the problem. You're not the problem. And it gave the client a kind of a sense of relief, like you're talking about, oh, geez, I'm not this defective person. It's, I have this problem, and I can work on this problem. Well, now we're similarly helping our clients understand that, well, geez, you mean it's my overactive amygdala, and I've got to come up with a better way to calm it down? That is a clearer way to empower them, and they have a sense of sensibility about it. Well, geez, oh, I see. It's this is the problem right here. And it's not that I'm this terrible person, or I can feel, would feel terrible about being this loser, but rather I'm just not using my brain as effectively as I might. And now I'm learning new ways to do just that, use my brain more effectively.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, there's a wonderful case example in the article, and I was going to ask you to maybe take us through a case, but I'm not sure we've got time to do that. So I really want to refer listeners to that article. And you've written some books on brain therapy that go more deeply into the specifics of how you might introduce the conversation about the brain into the discussion, and how you might encourage them to engage in one activity or another, and the effect that that would have. And I think maybe we're going to need to do another interview down the line to get into that level of detail. Would you be up for that?
Oh, I'd very much enjoy that.
Yeah. So how long do you think it'll take for this new brain-oriented perspective to become widely adopted?
Well, you know, it seems to me that there's a major interest internationally. I just came back a couple weeks ago from a speaking tour in Australia and New Zealand, and then and this is since I had lunch with you, and then went off to the East Coast to talk in six cities, and it seems that people are really excited about this new approach internationally. And let me say that it's less about a person. I always say that I don't care if you remember me afterwards. It's not about the latest guru and the latest school, but rather it's a collaborative approach. So you all in the audience could be out there giving seminars as well, as we all learn together, because there's a great sharing of information as neuroscience and psychotherapy research mature, I'm totally convinced that in 5-6 years, I'm going to be looking back at what I'm talking about now and going, God, what a limited understanding I had back then.
You're director of training for Northern California and the Kaiser Permanente Hospital System. Who are you training there, and what sorts of trainings have you set up?
Well, we have quite an elaborate mental health system in the Kaiser Permanente medical system in Northern California. We have 24 medical centers from Fresno to Santa Rosa. And within those 24 medical centers, we have mental health interns, pre-doc psychology interns, social work interns, practicum students, and about 65 postdocs. So roughly about 130 trainees in these 24 medical centers. And what we've been trying to do is create a much stronger focus on integrative healthcare. Now, I'm not trying to do a commercial for Kaiser Permanente here, but let me say a few things about our pluses. Integrative healthcare, I think, is the wave of the future in medicine, whereby the podiatrist can talk to the neurologist, can talk to the psychologist, and we can collaborate together. And one of the areas that I, as a psychologist, am most excited about it has been really for the last 25 years is psychoneuroimmunology, the interaction between how a person feels, how they think, and their immune system, their brain, rather than carve this all up. So what we're trying to instill within the mental health training program is a focus on this integrative healthcare and mental health being part of it, rather than just a slice off to the side whereby we refer our mental health client to some medical doctor and not know what's going on, but rather we're talking to the primary care physician, the neurologist, and so on. So what we're trying to do within my training program is to follow and participate in these major advances in healthcare. That is constantly changing, and I'm just real pleased to be part of it.
Now, in addition to your work as training director for Kaiser Permanente and your writing, you also lead a lot of workshops around the country and, as you told us, internationally. What are your workshops about, and how can one find out about your upcoming workshops?
Well, what I have been focusing on is this integrative model, and the workshops have been called brain-based therapy. So what I try to focus on is each subject area that has been unfortunately focused on independent of the other ones. So whether it's a 1 day, 2 day, or a week long one, like I do in Cape Cod, what I try to do is hit the high points of many different subject areas. And one of those that we haven't talked about at all today that I regard as incredibly important is to understand the memory systems. And so what I try to do is help psychotherapists glean some wisdom from the discoveries in these various subject areas. For example, attachment theory. We know [S2] Yes. [S1] A whole lot more about attachment and the brain dynamics related to secure versus insecure attachment and how it gets played out over the course of a lifetime, and also temperament. Thanks to a lot of work done, Chess and Thomas initially and Jerome Kagan and others around how temperamental differences play out over a lifetime and the interaction between attachment and temperament. So what I try to do is include in whether it's a day long, 2 day long or a week long seminar is try to weave together all these different fields of study into a grand integrative approach, which we ought to be, as psychotherapists, focusing on rather than our respective school. I even include facial expressions, Paul Ekman's work and others that have highlighted the uncanny and non-conscious intuitive perception of what another person's feeling just by these micro expressions. And we as psychotherapists are looking at our clients not knowing we're picking up on the way they're feeling, but we are. And so we ought to be paying attention to how these different brain, social brain networks work. You know, mirror neurons, the temporoparietal junction, and other areas of the brain, including anterior cingulate and the insula and others. What all these systems do together to make us much more sensitive to what's going on between us and a person that we're communicating to.
Well, you know, that's a good place for us to wrap it up. That's a good kind of closing statement, I think. I love how wide-ranging and your interests are and how enthusiastic you are and how you're a champion for integration. So it's great to speak with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, I've been delighted to talk to you today.
I hope you were stimulated by this interview with Dr. John B. Arden. By the way, you may have heard some hammering in the background during one point in the recording. Turns out John had some downstairs neighbors doing remodeling. He told them he needed quiet for a radio interview he'd be doing, but I guess they forgot. So we had to pause the interview so he could go down and remind them. We also had another interruption or two. Fortunately, I was able to edit most of that stuff out, but if you noticed any less than smooth transitions, that may have something to do with it. I was amazed to discover such an accomplished psychologist, the author of 12 books, no less, whom I had not previously heard of, living so close by. So thanks, Ashley Taggart, for so thoughtfully introducing me to him. I'm hoping he and I will find time for more lunches and perhaps some hikes out by the coast, which I understand he likes to do. I really encourage you to read the article he co-authored along with Dr. Lloyd Linford, which appeared in the Psychotherapy Networker. Fortunately, that article is available to the public online, and I put a link to it in the show notes. So if you're listening on a mobile device, you'll need to be sure to remember to go to the Shrink Wrap Radio site and get the link. While we were able to touch on many of the high points in our conversation, the article develops a very systematic and cogent argument for a new conception of psychotherapy that brings many of the already existing approaches under the same tent, and also suggests some changes in approach that more specifically leverage the new learnings coming out of neuroscience. He mentioned memory in passing toward the very end of our conversation. If we had more time, I would have gone after his take on memory reconsolidation, which I hope you will recall was the focus of my interview with Bruce Ecker, two interviews preceding this one. I'm hoping you're seeing the picture that is emerging from this neuroscience jag that I'm on. The interviews with Drs. Solms, Porges, Davidson, Ponksepp, Scher, and Swingle all contribute to what I think will be a major sea change in psychotherapy. In fact, I would have liked to call John's attention to Dr. Paul Swingle's book on biofeedback for the brain as a way of directly addressing intervention in specific cortical and subcortical regions. I'll have to contact John to find out if he knows about the work of both Swingle and Ecker, which I think articulate powerfully with his own. Furthermore, I have three more important researchers in my sights: Lou Cozzolino, who John mentioned, Judith Rustin, and Alan Shore. I'm in the process of lining them up. Two other of the many names John mentioned in our talk I've already interviewed, namely Scott D. Miller and David Barlow. Those interviews would also make good companion pieces for this one. So look for Shrink Wrap Radio number 66, What Really Works in Therapy with Scott D. Miller, Ph.D. The other you'll find in the archives at wisecounselpodcast.com. Look for an interview with David H. Barlow, PhD, on the nature and treatment of anxiety and panic disorders. Okay, you've got plenty of homework, students. Get to it.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
It's been a long time since I've played that one, and there might even be new listeners who haven't heard it. So I wanted to dust it off for the new year. Now, speaking of the new year, if you're not helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially, I hope you'll add that to your New Year's resolutions. It would give your brain a big shot of dopamine, and mine too. Just go to our website and click on that big green donate button. Your contribution, whether big or small, will help to keep the good stuff coming your way. While you're on our site, don't forget I've got a whole raft of CE course units that you can earn, mostly for just listening to these interviews. The latest is my new 8-unit CE course through the Zur Institute. Now, as you know, I've been on a real neuroscience kick lately, as today's interview with Dr. John Arden will testify, and this 8-unit course is part of my body-slash-mind-slash-spirit course sequence. This one is titled Brain, Insights from Neuroscience, and it includes interviews with such notables as Dan Siegel, David Eagleman, Stephen Porges, Daniel Amen, Richard Davidson, Sarah Lazar, Philippe Golden, Jill Bolte-Taylor, Temple Grandin, Shelley Carson, and more. Wow, just reading this list of powerhouse names knocks my socks off. Well, almost. In the next few days, I'm going to be putting out my latest newsletter in conjunction with the Jung platform. If you're not on our mailing list, you can add yourself to it. You'll see an entry form in the top left of the homepage. And in return, you'll get a free dream lecture that I gave some years back. Did you know that we also offer an iPhone/Android shrink wrap radio app? It's a great way to listen to these shows on the go. You'll find full details in the apps tab on our site. Once again, as always, please help to spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio. I just know there are lots of folks out there who would love this content if they only knew about it. As you know, it's also a great resource for teachers, students, grad students, and various sorts of therapists and personal coaches. As you know, most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free. Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides an incredible value, I think, and these transcripts are also extremely helpful to me when I'm putting together the CE courses and our newsletter, and any time that I need to quickly review what was covered in a given interview, because my memory is so bad. There's so much good info in these interviews, and I don't always remember it all. A quick refresher can be very useful, and I suspect that may be true for many of you as well. By the way, there are still a number of transcripts I'm waiting for, so if you volunteered, please get that transcript to me, or at least send me a status update. And in fact, I think I'm going to institute a new rule, which will be that transcription volunteers will need to get me their transcript within a month's time. If I don't hear from them after a month, I'll take their name off the site as working on that episode so that other volunteers can see that that episode is available. How draconian of me.
Hi, this is Dr. David Feinstein, psychologist, energy therapist, and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, David Feinstein, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Matthew Dolitz, who is founder and editor of the new online magazine/journal, the neuropsychotherapist, who wrote in reply to my thanks for an ongoing donation. In part, Matthew writes, I actually look forward to going somewhere in the car by myself because it gives me a chance to listen and re-listen to your podcasts. I've learned so much from them, and thank you for introducing me to so many wonderful people, approaches, and understandings in the world of psychology. As a musician, I get a kick out of your Dr. Dave intro music as well. Very cool. Well, Matthew, in as much as you're a musician, maybe you can put together some new Dr. Dave intro music. That would be very cool. And also, I should mention that Matthew has invited me to be on his editorial board. We've been doing some work together, and so I especially appreciate your financial support as well. Similarly, I received the following reply from Mustafa, who replied to my thanks for his ongoing donation. And Mustafa writes, thank you for your kind words. I am following your podcast for more than a year and have probably listened to more than 30 to 40 episodes, but only this week did I understand or get aware the first time how much energy and time you put into it, and especially your announcement at the end about the low rate of donations despite the high number of downloads made me relook at your work and contribution with a different lens. I am not in a helping profession, but a lifelong learner and deeply interested in human nature and being and living in the world, and many of the interviews have provided me genuine insights and introduced me to valuable resources, which I then dive deeper for more knowledge or plan to do so in the near future. I highly appreciate your work and wish you joy and a peaceful day, Mustafa. I am so happy to hear from you, Mustafa, and to know that my plea for donations, the one in which I occasionally mention the hourly rate, which I seem to be working at, which is around $10 an hour. So I really appreciate your donation. And I got some follow-up email from Mustafa, who has a very interesting background. He lives in Moscow, Russia, for the past 11 years. He's an electrical engineer. He was born in Istanbul, Turkey. He grew up in Berlin, West Germany, went to the university in Ankara, Turkey, and he works and has lived for the past 19 years in Russia. So what an interesting fellow. And at the same time, he's interested in humanities and liberal arts. So I'm so happy to have a listener in Russia. And also that same week, I think just either the same day even, I heard from someone in Russia who wants to translate some of the episodes for other listeners there in Russia. And of course, I said yes. And so now I know I have at least two listeners in Russia. If there are more, let me know. Next, we hear from Dalton, who writes, Dear Dave, I'm responding to your interview with Dr. David Shane. I've included an attachment, which is a collection of writings by Stephen Hoadley, an alcoholic-slash-addicted writer, who despite his addiction wrote very well about life as an addict. I found it to be powerful stuff and not the common chicken soup type of stuff. I've worked in the recovery field for the past 7 years, and recovery at best nationally is 20%, not 30%. It's dismal. The spiritual awakening often cited by those who have recovered, in almost all cases, has nothing to do with organized religion. Spirituality is a collection of principles to live by, and the God to which they refer to is the God of my understanding. That's in quotes, the God of my understanding. Dalton goes on to say, the distinction is important in that the dominant characteristic in addiction is contempt, and as a result, the addict rejects authority, so a God of their understanding slash higher power is more palatable to them and a source they can lean on to fortify their resolve. Anyway, I thought you might find Stephen's writings interesting and different. The language is a bit crude, but real, as are the descriptions and stories Stephen is dead now. Sincerely, Dalton. And he sent me an attachment that had some writings by Stephen. I'm sure that you could find him on Google. That was Stephen Hoadley, H-O-A-D-L-E-Y. So Dalton, thank you for alerting me to that. Finally, here's one last one from retired psychologist Barclay, who followed up an earlier letter of appreciation from her that I read on the last show with a and she followed that up with a donation. And she writes, "Thanks, David, for such a prompt and upbeat note. Actually, making the donation to you was good for regaining my own mojo after the holiday effects." Your responsiveness makes this connection feel even better than it was already feeling before I first wrote to you. I believe in donating where the nourishment and inspiration come from. Just wish I could have given at a level more commensurate with my gratitude. Meanwhile, I had the delight of hearing you read my letter of appreciation on Sunday morning when I returned to episode 331 to finish listening to the last section of David Shane's interesting interview. It was fascinating and fun to hear my words spoken over the air, and it made me happy to hear the warmth in your voice as you read them. As well, I'm glad to hear you giving yourself a week off, for it seems to me the most generous thing you can do for everyone is to take good care of yourself. I'm rooting for your enthusiasm for this incredible project to continue. Gratefully, Barclay." And as I said before, I really appreciate your support, Barclay, and it's especially meaningful coming from another psychologist and also such a fluent communicator as well. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on my phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails on our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. John B. Arden, for sharing his work on the implications of neuroscience for the practice of psychotherapy. My next guest will be Dr. David Feinstein, who is the leading expert in the field of what's known as energy therapy, which includes EFT, emotional freedom technique, and TFT, thought field therapy. He's finally been able to get some recognition for these approaches from the American Psychological Association, and I think you'll find his work particularly stimulating. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.